Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. There's a new book about the University of North Carolina School of Medicine and about its founding dean, or the founding dean of the four-year medical school at Carolina, W. Reese Berryhill. Co-author is Bill McClendon, who's with us, and his co-authors who are not with us are Floyd Denny Jr. And William Blythe, all three of whom are retired emeriti professors at the medical school at the University of North Carolina. And Bill McClendon, you've had to work without your other two laborers for some time, but your book's about to come out. How you feel about it?
Well, it's exciting. It's been
about took you a couple of weeks, didn't it?
That's right. No, it's been about 10 years, and my wife is particularly excited. No, we started, Floyd got us together. Floyd Denny, who was a second chair of pediatrics at UNC, got Bill Blythe and me together about 10 years ago to start working on a biography of Dr. Berryhill. Floyd said that Berryhill, every stone and brick in the medical center was a tribute to Berryhill, but nobody knew why or why we recognized that. So this was an effort to try to bring this together in a way we could see what went on in the history.
Well, you know, it's an interesting choice that you and your colleagues made to combine history and biography. And tell us about how you came to that choice. This is a biography of Reese Berryhill, and it is a history of the, I guess, the modern UNC School of Medicine.
Exactly. Well, I think model was Barbara Tuchman said that biography serves as a useful purpose for focusing both the reader and the writer in terms of making some broad story more accessible. And her biography of General Joe Stilwell and the American experience in China is a good example of that. So I think that was what we had in mind, is to use Berryhill's life as a framework, as a framework of seeing the evolution of the university, of the medical school, and of medical education in North Carolina, because all of the medical schools are so interrelated that this, while it focuses on the UNC school, is actually has significant insight into why we have a Duke University Medical School, why we have a Wake Forest Medical School at Winston, and what happened to the several other medical schools that are no longer with us.
Well, how about, since this is a biography of Dr. Berryhill, since his name is plastered on the medical school, since many of us knew his wife, Norma Berryhill, who lived past 100 and only died a year or two ago, and his daughter, many of us know Cat Williams, his daughter, but very, fewer and fewer of us know Dr. Berryhill. How about telling us a little bit about his life story?
All right. Well, he was born in 1900, and the title for the book, The Bettering the Health of the People, came from the fact that Bill Blythe, when he started to write this chapter, looked to see what was happening in Charlotte the day Dr. Berryhill was born in October of 1900. It turned out that President Francis Venable had given the University Day address in Chapel Hill and had 2 days previously, and it was published in its entirety in the Charlotte Observer the day Dr. Berryhill was born. And one of the things he says, the University of the People molds the leaders of the people, and it gives birth to great movements which improve the condition of the people. So that, and I doubt Berryhill ever saw this. I'm pretty sure he
didn't.
It's
just a coincidence.
But it was purely a coincidence. So it gave us the title of Bettering the Health of the People. So he grew up in rural Mecklenburg County and at Steel Creek in southern Mecklenburg County. You grew up in northern Mecklenburg County.
Right.
And Bill Blythe.
Berryhill name was very prominent in the history of Mecklenburg County. When I was growing up, the junior highs and the high schools until, well, for a long time, there was a Berryhill High School.
Exactly.
It got consolidated. And so we knew the Berryhill name both from history and then from current events. So it was a strong Mecklenburg County name.
Right. And he originally intended to be he was active, or his family had been long active in the Steel Creek Presbyterian Church there, and he intended to be a Presbyterian minister and was going to Davidson, again, where you went to school, but he did a debating had a debating contest at UNC Chapel Hill when he was in high school, and they convinced him that he should come to Chapel Hill, which he did.
Well, I mean, it's the old Chapel Hill's always stealing. Stole Charlie Scott and Reese Berryhill.
That's
and,
right.
And Bill Blythe.
That's
from,
right.
From Davidson. I guess it's teasing to ask you the question, but would, from what you know of Dr. Berryhill, what kind of Presbyterian preacher would he have been?
Well, he would probably have been pretty good because he...
organizing.
He was organizing.
He would push and he would preach.
And, that's right. No, I think he would have probably been pretty good. And one of the interesting sidelines we came across in his application to Harvard Medical School, he said he had always, since he could first remember, wanted to be a doctor, and yet he didn't decide to become a doctor until he was a freshman or sophomore at UNC. So we said he probably had a smile on his face whenever he read this in applications from students who were applying to medical school.
Well, in 1900, there were very few people in North Carolina with a great amount of wealth. What was his family, poor, wealthy, or in between? Were they farmers, or what was...
They were basically farmers, and I think, you know, were not poverty-stricken, but certainly were never wealthy. And in fact, he got a free tuition at the university in a program they had then that you could get free tuition if you would teach for 2 years.
If you'd agree to teach.
If you'd agree to teach.
And so did he do that?
And so after he graduated in the class of 1921 as an undergraduate, he went to Charlotte and taught in high school for 2 years.
Who were some of his contemporaries at Carolina during those times?
Well, he was here with quite an impressive group in that class that... Thomas Wolfe graduated the year before he did, and then a number of other very well-known people of that era were in that class.
Frank Graham himself was not far from that.
That's right.
I guess
He was an earlier class, but was about that same time.
This was the time that Edward Kidder Graham, this was the time of the flu epidemic as well as...
Exactly. And so when... Berryhill came, the World War I started, and he didn't go in the military service, all the students were in various military units. And right as the war ended, the influenza epidemic pandemic hit in November of 1918, and Edward Kidder Graham, the president, died, and then his successor also died in that influenza.
What kind of student life did Reese Berryhill have as an undergraduate at Chapel Hill?
Well, he turned out to be a strong leader in the student body. He was involved in many activities. He ended up being president of the senior class. He was voted the most best all-around student in the class. And so he was very active, and I think he showed early on his leadership roles. And yet at the same time, he was a very reticent person. And all of the pictures that we came, group pictures that we came about from that era up until even when he was dean, if there was a group picture, he was in the back row. He was never front and center, except in situations where there were just a few people, obviously.
Well, now you mentioned that he had this commitment to go back and teach. And how did that go? And how did that lead to his connection with the medical school?
Well, he decided after teaching that he had become committed during his undergraduate years to go into medicine. So he came back for what was then the two-year school, the basic science school at Chapel Hill. And at that point, it was at Caldwell Hall across from the Arboretum. And so he had his 2 years there. But then he and all the other students had to go out of state for their MD degree. In fact, at that time, there were no MD degree schools. The first one, the current ones, was Duke in 1930.
I'm talking to Dr. Bill McClendon, who's the co-author of Bettering the Health of the People, a biography of Reese Berryhill, the founding dean, and history of the UNC School of Medicine. He and I'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Dr. Bill McClendon, a professor emeritus at the UNC School of Medicine and the co-author of Bettering the Health of the People, a book that will be here soon. And it is a biography of Dr. Reese Berryhill, somebody, Bill McClendon, we hear a lot about. because he was the kind of pusher to get us going with the four-year medical school here. And you're telling me the story of Dr. Barry Hill. We'll get to the School of Medicine in a minute. I guess we'll get to it right now because you got him ready to come back to the two-year medical school.
Exactly.
About what year would this have been?
That would have been 1923. He'd been teaching in Charlotte for 2 years, and then to pay back his tuition.
What's the School of Medicine, UNC School of Medicine, like in 1922? What is it?
Well, it was...
Have all these skyscrapers, hospitals and all this stuff there?
No, it was just the little Caldwell Hall, the yellow brick building there across from the Arboretum.
Now, we got probably 1,000 doctors on the faculty, and then hundreds, maybe thousands of other people on the faculty and staff.
Right.
How many people were on the faculty of the medical school?
I think there were probably less than 10 at that point.
And how many students?
And about 40 a class.
40 per class.
So there'd
be two classes.
So only about 80
students. Fewer than 100.
Yeah.
Fewer than 100.
Mm-hmm.
And what? How did Dr. Barry Hill do?
He did very well. He'd done very well scholastically and in the leadership as an undergraduate, in the same way as a medical student. So when it came time for him to transfer to the clinical schools, he was recommended to go to several of the best schools in the nation and ended up being accepted and went to Harvard Medical School for his 2-year degree.
What was his experience like? This would have been the typical experience for people who completed the 2-year program at the UNC School of Medicine. They couldn't practice medicine. They had to do something
exactly.
else.
Exactly. That's right.
And their only choice, I guess, was to go to another medical school if they could get in.
That's right. And so he, you know, in one sense, I'm sure it was overwhelming going from Steel Creek and Chapel Hill to Boston and everything. But in the other way, he was very excited about it. And Norma Berryhill, he had met Norma Berryhill, Norma Connell, but before they were married. But she related that he felt like he died and gone to heaven. He was so excited to be there where they had all the big hospitals, Boston City, Mass General, and so forth, and all the patients. And so he really thoroughly soaked this up. It was, you know, a little bit of an adjustment, but he thoroughly enjoyed it. And he did so well as a medical student that he was got the first position in the Harvard service at the Boston City Hospital
to
as
do
an
his,
intern.
His internship,
right.
as they called it then. Didn't
it was
call
still
it a residency?
They didn't have a residency. It was sort of a longer internship.
I see.
But as a senior intern, it was equivalent to a chief resident today.
So this is the first place that he saw in action what a high-powered, I don't want to say real, but a four-year medical school with attached teaching and research facilities could be.
And speaking of the research, at the Boston City Hospital, they had the Thorndike Labs, which was one of the first clinical research units in the country. And Dr. Minot, who was one of his mentors, had done pioneering work on treatment of pernicious anemia, which in those days was pernicious, and today it's easily treated. And so he would soon get the Nobel Prize for his work. So Barry Hill was exposed to people who were expert clinicians, enthusiastic teachers, and also excellent investigators.
So he saw the difference between what was apparently a fine 2-year medical school, but it didn't have the contact with patients and the ongoing clinical education that is important to making fine doctors, nor did it have associated with it the high-powered research that Harvard did.
Exactly.
And we don't know for sure whether this began eating on him right away or whether he just took this in stride. And
well, I think he considered this a model of what he'd like to see here. And it certainly it helped when he got around to establishing the school. It gave him some national standards by which he could set up the school, and more importantly, it gave him excellent context for recruiting, so that a number of the outstanding first clinical people here were from Boston, certainly not exclusively Harvard.
Well, when did he finish up in Boston?
He finished in 1929, and went back to Charlotte with the idea of going into practice of internal medicine, but that was right when the Depression was hitting, and so in the meantime, his one of his associates, or one of his mentors at Harvard, Joe Wern, who also was from Mecklenburg County, a few years ahead of Berryhill, had been recruited from Harvard to Western Reserve University at Cleveland as head of medicine. And Wern called Berryhill and said, would you be my chief resident in medicine and a junior faculty member? So Berryhill went to Cleveland for 3 years with Wern.
Now, is it your theory that if we'd had good economic times, that Reese Berryhill would have just gone on the private practice of medicine and things would have been quite different here?
Well, that's certainly possible, right. I think he certainly had a leaning towards academic medicine, and so it was fortuitous, if you will, that he knew Wern, Wern knew him and respected him.
Well, how long did he stay in Cleveland, and what happened to
him
there?
He was 3 years there, and in the meantime, right before he went to Cleveland, he and Norma were married, so she went with him, and they had their first.
Now they had a long courtship, though.
Well,
they didn't
did. They had about a 10-year courtship, and they had their first daughter Jane there, and then their second daughter Catherine or Kat was after they came back to Chapel Hill.
Now, what brought him back to Chapel Hill?
Well, at the time when he was considering leaving Cleveland, he considered private practice. The Duke University Medical School had opened in 1930. He considered that. And it was a possibility he could stay in Cleveland, although things were not didn't look too well there in the Depression. And so Frank Graham, who had been appointed president of UNC in 1931, finally ended up recruiting Berryhill back as the university physician in charge of the infirmary with a faculty appointment in the medical school to teach the clinical introductory courses for the second year.
Well,
semester.
Now you mentioned these Mecklenburg County connections, and these were two Mecklenburg County boys, weren't they? Were they just Mecklenburg County people?
No, that just happened to be a coincidence.
That was a coincidence,
I think, right?
What? He came back not to the medical school, but to practice medicine as in the infirmary.
Mm-hmm. He was in charge of in the Abernathy Hall, which is the tan brick building right across diagonally across from Carolina Inn and the Deke House. And so he was in charge. And one of the times he was talked to Chancellor House and said, "We can't teach this course on physical on good health to certain group of students because we're seeing 200 boys a day during a flu epidemic or something, you know." And so they were busy, you know. They had a busy time there.
The activity, well, you think of college students as being generally in good health, but they do get sick.
Exactly.
And particularly when an epidemic goes
right
through.
And then, but he did devote a lot of time during the 1930s before he was dean to organizing and teaching these courses in physical diagnosis and introduction to medicine, which meant he had to go to Watts Hospital or the State Sanatorium or some of these other hospitals.
So this was in a two-year medical school. You were giving them the first little taste of clinical medicine, but you had to take them off campus.
Exactly, that's right.
And so that's what they would do, put them in a bus or something and take them to a real hospital,
right.
Now, how did this work lead to him becoming the dean and of the medical school?
Well, Dr. Billy McNida, who was another one of the giants in the history of the medical school, and who was a professor for almost 50 years, and after whom McNida Hall was his name, accepted the deanship of the medical school reluctantly in the late 1930s and insisted that Dr. Berryhill be associate dean or assistant dean. And Dr. Berryhill said, "I don't want to be dean. We've got too damn many deans here already." But Frank Graham was equally forceful and called him up and said, "Dr. Berryhill, you are the assistant dean. You'll report to Dean McNida tomorrow morning." So there were some interesting people in those days. So that's where he first got his introduction to medical administration.
Well, so we got Dr. Berryhill. It's right before the beginning of the Second World War. He's ensconced as the assistant dean. Mm-hmm. And we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, my guest. is Dr. Bill McClendon, Professor Emeritus at the UNC School of Medicine, talking about the book Bettering the Health of the People, which is just about ready to come out. And it is a history of the UNC School of Medicine, a biography of Rhys Berryhill. And you've got Rhys Berryhill at the UNC School of Medicine in about the beginning of World War II. He's about to become dean, and something else is happening. World War II's coming. What does that have to do with the story?
Well, Berryhill, when he in his first report as dean in 1941, he said, obviously, we can't start building a four-year school in a hospital now, but that we need to start planning now for a hospital after and for expanded medical school. And one of the things that led them, he and other people around the state, to this was the fact that during World War II, North Carolina had the worst rejection rate for its young men of any of the 48 states. At one time, 57% of the North Carolina young men, or boys as they said then, were rejected for medical reasons for military service. And when a later report was done, they said this wasn't the most surprising finding we found, but we found that young men who'd grown up in orphanages where they had sound but inexpensive nutrition and medical care had only a 3% rejection. So they weren't saying it was good to be an orphan.
50% versus 3%.
Yeah, they weren't saying that it was good to be an orphan. They were saying that it showed that good health care was an achievable goal.
Now, how did that relate to Dr. Berryhill's dream of a four-year medical school?
Well, he started in the 40s getting a group of former presidents and current presidents of the Medical Society together, and they presented a report in 1944 to Governor Broughton saying that we need to start planning right now for a medical school after the war for an expanded school. Governor Broughton appointed the Medical Care and Hospital Commission with Clarence Poe, who was editor of the Progressive Pharma, as the chairman, and so its report became known as the Poe Report. And they studied for about a year and came up with recommendations that there be a four-year medical school at Chapel Hill, that hospitals be built around the state, that also they asked not only for more doctors and more hospitals, but for more insurance, meaning access to care. And in fact, Governor Broughton's charge to the committee had been that the goal of this program is that no one in North Carolina will be denied needed health care as a result of lack of funding.
Well, now you've mentioned in your book that Dr. Berryhill was persistent. Now, he knew he wanted a four-year medical school, or that Chapel Hill needed a four-year medical school, and in order to have the four-year medical school, it needed to have a hospital. So he wanted it, whether there was bad news in that report or not, but he took the bad news and made it an asset, for put it in service to his dream, or his goal, I guess, of having a four-year medical school.
And I think the one thing that he did, and Frank Graham, who was president, were careful to say that the medical school was a part of this, but that this was a statewide plan, that we needed to improve hospitals and care throughout the state. So they balanced this. And so he pushed for this medical school here. And one of the there were several key issues that were debated between the time of the report in 1945 and the legislative action in 1947, which started the ball rolling to build what we now have here at Chapel Hill. There were several things going on. Some people in the two, there were only two schools then, two private schools, Wake Forest and Duke. And naturally, some people there said, well, just give us the money and it'll be much cheaper for us to expand. Mm-hmm. And it was the same argument that the people at Chapel Hill used in the 70s to say, we don't need an East Carolina medical school. So history has a way of repeating itself.
And how did Dr. Berryhill and his allies meet that argument?
Well, they said that the state needed a state school, that it could do things that the private school couldn't do. And also, the other key thing that he really pushed for, and Dr. McKnight I had previously, and Frank Graham also, was that a medical school should be on the university campus, that it made no sense in today with the way
medical. So the idea was once you won the argument that we needed a public university medical school, there would be those who would say, you need a teaching hospital and you don't have one in Chapel Hill,
exactly.
So let's don't go to the expense of building another big hospital. Let's go send the medical school where the hospital is.
Exactly.
And what's wrong with that argument?
Well, it's two problems. One, that you get in, if you go to a community that already has an existing hospital, then you've got the problem of the existing staff versus the medical school staff. And so this can be a major knockdown battles in many institutions where this happened. But even more importantly, that if you don't have the medical school, the entire medical school, basic science and clinical, and the hospital on the university campus, then you lose that synergy that comes from being on a campus where you have departments of physics and chemistry and biology and the university libraries and now computer science and all of these things that go into making an approach to health care that we like to do today.
Well, now you mentioned that you've made this biography not a great man biography, but you've talked about Dr. Berryhill as a human being with great strengths and some faults as well. During this time when he was fighting for this, who did he have to fight with, and did he ever get in any big battles with anybody?
Well, he had, you know, there were fights politically with the various people who were opposed to this, and he wasn't always, he was more in the background on those. But
What about in the internal fighting in the university?
Right. Well, there was a lot of fighting in the university. I mean, there was a certain amount in that there was a division of health affairs, which he actually had advocated because he didn't feel that as dean of the medical school, he could pay adequate attention to the other schools, the dentistry, nursing, pharmacy, public health, and so forth. And so he advocated that. And then when a director, Henry Clark, was recruited here, Berryhill and Henry Clark had some battles over
priorities. Dr. Berryhill fought for the medical school, and Dr. Clark had to fight for the resources
for all schools. I mean, he wasn't against the medical school by any means. But he, and so I think in the long run, at the time, it was a fairly, it was a battle.
Everybody knew that they were strong words.
That's right. But I think in the long run, it turned out well because now we have five schools of health sciences that all rank near the very top in their particular areas. And the other thing, which most people don't realize, is that out of the 125 medical schools in the United States, UNC is one of only some six schools that have these five health science schools, the hospital, all on a university campus. So it's a fairly unique, and that we're only now beginning to see the importance of that with the Leinberger Cancer Center and its research and this new research fund that's come, where they're not looking at cancer just as a surgical problem or medical problem, but they can bring in all of the different resources, the computer science people, the basic chemistry and physics people.
All of this, you argue, might not have been quite as successful had the medical school been in an isolated or been in a different community from the academic and research component of the other parts of the university.
Exactly. And one of the things that Berryhill did, even while he was fighting the battle to get the approval here, he recruited in 1946 Kenneth Brinkhaus from Iowa to be chairman of pathology. And this was a very far-sighted thing because Brinkhaus introduced the modern team approach to research, which characterizes Chapel Hill research today. And
let me ask you this, because right now we have this impression, it's probably not accurate, that the people who are doing the research on the primarily on the medical school campus, but also throughout the university, they are stars and they go out and persuade the federal government and other granting entities to give them money to fund their research. But jump-starting a research effort on a campus that didn't have that tradition, that must have been a challenge. And how did that happen?
Well, it was very slow. Berryhill had to be prodded sometimes to do this, but he did get the resources.
Let me interrupt you. He had to be prodded. Why? Because his focus was on what?
Well, his focus was on the clinical side
on
first.
Clinical.
But I say that, but he was equally...
Well, who prodded him?
Some of the faculty.
Brickhouse?
Some of the faculty. He recruited a lot of young faculty.
So he recruited high-powered faculty, and then they took over and said, we didn't come here just to practice medicine or just to teach. Yeah. We like to be in the lab. I mean,
in essence, that's true. No, so that... He was not adverse to this. It was just a question of priorities. And so I think he came around to see. And today, recently, UNC was cited as one of only four of 125 medical schools that's in the top 20 in both educating primary health physicians and in NIH research funds. So it's not an either-or sort of thing. You know, there's some schools in this country that say we're just creating the family doctors for the small towns. The others that say we're creating the next generation of researchers and departmental chairs. This school has been able to successfully do both. And the fact that we had a Nobel Prize winner here 2 weeks ago is an example of the success in that side, and the fact that we have a AHEC system that takes medical education throughout the state in association with all four of the medical schools is a testimony to the fact that we're very much concerned about education for doctors at the community level and other healthcare.
Your argument in summary is it's a good place to have a medical school on a college campus, a public university campus, mm-hmm. because you get that the inter workings of bright people spurring each other on in a research effort, and you get the public service mandate from the being a public university, all in connection with the principal objective, I guess, still is training good clinicians to go out throughout the state and serve the people. Well, Bill McClendon's covered all this in his colleague's new book, Bettering the Health of the People. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. Bill McClendon, who is the co-author of Bettering the Health of the People, subtitled W. Reese Berryhill, the UNC School of Medicine and the North Carolina Good Health Movement, all part of one big book, Bill, and it's a big package, and you with your colleagues who left you are the great Bill Blythe and Floyd Denny. You've carried on that work. Give them credit as co-author, but you had to pull it all together, didn't you?
I did, by
yourself.
But it would never have happened without the two of them. Floyd got us together about 10 years ago to get started on this project, and then Bill was an essential part of it. And after Bill's sudden passing in 2000 and Floyd's passing the next year, I came very close to dropping the project, but it was such a compelling story that I somehow or another just couldn't do it. And thanks to the support of my bride Ann, I've kept on. And so it's exciting to begin to see this coming together now.
Well, we won't in this hour be able to finish that story, but give us a taste of what Dean Berryhill faced as the four-year medical school came into existence and the hospital got built.
Well, part of it was financial in the sense that he was an idealist in wanting it here on the university campus, but it was very slow getting started because transportation wasn't what it is now. Most of the patients that came were indigent, and so Bill Aycock, who was chancellor in the early 1950s, told me that there was somebody from the budget office in Raleigh that would call the hospital every day to see what the census was to try to figure out how much the hospital was losing, to anticipate how much the hospital was losing. So that was one of the problems in trying to do
so that. So it became a financial, the hospital quickly became a financial drain on the state, and that always leads to tension.
That's right. And I think it's the credit of the subsequent deans and to Eric Munson, who was president of the hospital for some 25 years, that they were able to turn this around and establish what we have now.
And make it a sustainability
for
the hospital. Well, why do all of you all in the medical, for the old-timers in the mm-hmm. medical school, why is it that you feel so strongly about Dean Berryhill?
Well, I think that he had a vision for something that he wouldn't let loose. He would bit into this, and he wasn't going to let it loose until he saw it happen. And I think he also, although most of us as medical students were sort of terrified about him, he was a very imposing, strict sort of person. But on the other hand, he was a very warm and caring person when the occasion rose. So we had a great admiration for him and for what he did. And he was not perfect.
What do you mean he wasn't perfect?
Well, he had his problem. He would be frustrated. He would get angry. And he was even paranoid sometimes when resources would go to other.
Well, was this just the downside of this persistence, or did it really have a negative impact and keep him from doing some things that he might have done better had he not had these qualities?
I think they balanced with his good qualities and his persistence, so that no one is perfect, but I don't know that he would accomplish much more if he'd have been a different person.
Well, what about at home? I mean, we have this dream of him and Norma having this wonderful relationship, mm-hmm. but they were two strong-willed people. Did they always get along? Did they?
Yeah, no, they did. At least in public, never saw any conflict. But I'm sure they had great debates in private. And she was an essential part of his success, and that's why we say this isn't a biography of a great man. It's a biography of a partnership, really. And
it is hard for us with the medical school. And the medical school complex, really like a mini Manhattan over there,
exactly,
with skyscrapers going up and research. It's just hard to imagine the medical school that Dr. Burial came with 80 students and 12 faculty mm-hmm. or 10 faculty or something like that. But it's different. But now you've looked at that. You've got the history background. What about the future? What are the challenges that the future Dr. Berryhills have to face with medical education on this and making a place, sustaining this great service that we provide and attending to the health of the people, as you talk about in your title of your book?
Well, I think that is one of the challenges, obviously is one of the challenges, and I think one of the advantages of going back over this is that it recaptures the visions that people have had for this university and its service to the state, dating back to Venerable in 1900, to Edward Kittagraham, who said the boundaries of the university are coterminous with the boundaries of the state, and that we should be in sensitive care, touch with all the problems of the state. Frank Graham, Berryhill, McNida, and so forth, saying that the medical school should be, Berryhill used the term, should be physically and spiritually part of the university. Mm-hmm. And so I think it helps reinforce those basic reasons of why we're here doing the study. And so in the appendix, we quote some of the reports that go into this detail. So I think that's important. And I think if we can keep our eye on that, we're going to have tremendous financial burdens in the future. I mean, healthcare in general in this country. And so we've got to have be fiscally responsible. But at the same time, we don't want to lose the reason why we're here. Yeah. And the way I sum it up is that, sometimes people talk about, what about the conflict between patient care and education and research? And I say it's all patient care. The patient care we give at the ACC or the hospital today is care for today's patients, and we try to give the best scientifically sound and humane care we can. But the people that are doing research and education, they are also concerned with patient care, but for tomorrow's mm-hmm. patients, that we're doing this in order to assure that patients here and around the country get much better care tomorrow. So I think if we can focus on some of these broader visions, that we can deal with these problems that will inevitably be coming up.
Bill McClendon, thanks for taking time to describe your book. We look forward to its arrival. Dr. Bill McClendon is a professor emeritus at the UNC School of Medicine and is the co-author, along with the late Floyd Denny and the late William Leith, of Bettering the Health of the People, W. Reese Berryhill, the UNC School of Medicine, and the North Carolina Good Health Movement. And you've done a good job of giving us a preview. We look forward to reading the book.
Thank you very much for the opportunity of being with you.
Thanks, Bill McClendon. Thanks, all y'all, for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.